We are doing Pirkei Avot, and we're up to the fifth chapter. The fifth chapter is going to begin with an enumeration of a few things that are tens. We begin with creation, and we seem to go in chronological order. And then at the very end, we come back to creation. The first Mishnayot are easy to remember. They're the Mishnayot that revolve around numbers. Initially 10, then we go on to 7, then we go on to 8. So those are easy. It's easy to remember where these Mishnayot are located in Pirkei Avot. So the first Mishnah tells us, "Ba'asara ma'amarot nivra ha'olam." The world was created with God saying 10 things. God said, "Vayomer Elokim yehi or," let there be light, and there was light. So there were 10 things that God said to create the world. Now, technically, why is that necessary? Says the Mishnah, "Umat amud lomar." And why is this told to us in the Torah? What's that teaching us? God could have created the world with one declaration. God could have just said, let there be a world, and there would have been a world. Instead, we have that whole first section of Bereshit where God goes saying after saying, let there be this, let there be that, day after day. Now, what's the idea behind all that? Says the Mishnah, Ela, but the reason why the Torah specifies that the world was created with 10 declarations is to indicate to us that the world was something that required some investment. And then God says, I will avenge, I will take back, I will pay back the wicked that they destroy the world that was created with 10 declarations. If you work for 5 minutes to create something and then your sibling comes in and bashes it, it's not such a big deal. You work on a masterpiece and your sibling comes in and bashes it after 3 months worth of work, then you're going to be slightly more upset. So the verse stresses, so to speak, God's investment in the world to tell us that God will pay back the wicked who destroy the world. What does it mean they destroy the world? So there are many meanings here. This can be taken on many levels. What does it mean that the wicked that destroy the world that was created with 10 sayings are going to be paid back? How did they destroy the world? So this could be understood in a simple sense. They're destructive people. It could be understood in a deeper sense that every human being is like a whole world, and they destroy themselves. A person that very often when he's bad onto others, he's also bad onto himself, and God is going to take them to task for their self-destructive behavior. Even that, they're going to be punished for. And then there's also a spiritual understanding here that we're always told to view the world as being in perfect sync, in perfect balance. You have people sinning, you have people doing good deeds, and the world is balanced. Along comes this guy, and he chooses to be a wicked person. So he tilts the scale. He makes it that the whole world is in a state where it's undeserving. It doesn't deserve to stay around. So every one of us has to think that we're the ones that could tilt the scale either way, and we have a responsibility to tilt it for the good. Now, this is said on a spiritual level, but we could also understand it on a more simplistic level. On a simple level, at every moment you could start a cycle going this way, you could start a cycle going that way. A parent has a short fuse, right? He gets upset quickly, so he yells at the kid. The kid goes to school, he's upset, he's antsy, he yells at the teacher. He gets the teacher upset, the teacher yells at the other kids. How many kids aren't going to learn today because that parent yelled at their kid because he had a short fuse? There are cycles in this world. This is a small example. There are bigger examples. You could be the teller. A bus driver once told me, said to me, my job is the toughest job because I could be nice to 100 people, 300 people, and 300 people are nice to me. But I deal with thousands of people each day. So I could be nice to 300 people, and the 301st is a guy who's had a bad day, and he treats me in a rotten way, and now go continue having a nice day when someone treated you rottenly. So now that guy gets on the bus, he's a grouch. He treats the driver as a grouch. Now the driver has a bad day. and he treats his passengers in turn. I don't think it's going to kill anyone's day, but maybe he'll be less apt to open the door for you. Maybe when you're running to catch that bus, and then you're going to say, oh, these Israeli bus drivers, right? Well, there are cycles in the world. There are cycles. What we do affects beyond our immediate area. And we have to remember that. I'm giving simple examples, but if you think about it more deeply, it's bigger examples, because the question of how we behave is not just a question of a moment. It's a question of an attitude to life. It's a question of are we going to let the things that upset us make us into people that are upset. Like it says, the hallmark of a tzaddik, the hallmark of a chassid, is that even at a time where he is very, very upset on the inside, on the outside he has a nice countenance. He treats people pleasantly. So when we say that Russia is bringing the world down, so we can understand that on the levels we said earlier, we can also understand it on a more simple level. At the end of the day, we each have a potential for pushing the world in one direction or the other. What? You're right. To God, it isn't a big deal. But at the same time, God speaks in our terms. If it took us a longer time to build something, then it's of more value. It's more valuable to us. And when people destroy it or make it better, so then we... The idea is the Torah always speaks from our perspective. God doesn't get upset, God isn't happy, God isn't sad. Those are terms that are used for us to understand. So by the same token, the Torah tells us God created the world with 10 declarations to indicate to us that it was something, from our perspective, we should understand that there was an investment in it. Now, this brings us to another discussion, which I don't think we'll go into now, and that is why do the wicked get punished? Meaning, over here the Mishnah seems to say they're getting punished because they're destroying the world. They're destructive. Okay. If that's so, then what are tzaddikim doing? Meaning, is there a zero? Is there a neutral? Or are we always either up or down? Meaning, so the Mishnah says the indication is God created the world with 10 declarations. In order to explain to us why he's going to pay back the wicked who are destroying the world that was created with such an effort, veliten sachar tov latzadikim, and to give good wages to the tzadikim shem kaimin to'olam shenivra ba'asra ma'amarot, that they uphold the world that was created with 10 declarations, right? Tzadik yisod olam. The tzadik is the foundation of the world. He teaches the world how to behave. He's a good example. The question is, which way does it go? Meaning, when I'm just living my life, I'm leading a simple life. Am I building the world? Am I keeping things status quo? Am I going to get anything for it? Or I'm just a parav, I'm in the middle. So we saw on the Mishnah, Lo Amaretz Chassid, the Amaretz can't be a Chassid. So we said, yeah, but the Amaretz can be a Yerei Chet. The Amaretz, we saw at least one understanding that the Amaretz is he's up a notch. He's like the neutral. Meaning you have the boor where he's fallow land. He doesn't even know how to. He doesn't know how to run a business. He doesn't know how to run his life. He's just a bum who's sapping society of its energies, and he's not productive. The Amoritz is at least productive. The question here is: are we talking on a simple level, or are we talking on a more spiritual level? And all the commentaries seem to understand we're talking on a more spiritual level. The Mekaminet Olam and the Meavdinet Olam. Okay, Mishnah Beis. Asara dorot me'adam ve'ad Noach. There were 10 generations from Adam till Noach. Lo'diya kamer chapayim lefanav. And this indicates to us how much God is slow to anger. Shekol adorot yu machisin uva'in. That all the generations were angering one after another. Ad she'evi aleim tamabul. Took 10 generations for the flood. And the Mishnah isn't mentioning that God sent prophets to warn the people, and God made a tsunami that wiped out a third of civilization before the flood. The Mishnah isn't mentioning all of that. The Mishnah just says the 10 generations are an indication that God was patient before he brought the flood. עשרה דורות מנוח ועד אברהם, you have 10 generations from Noach till Avraham, להודיע כמה ערך הפעמים לפניו, again to show us how slow God is to anger, שכל הדורות היו מכעיסים ובאים, all the generations were angering, they were pagans, even though they knew God created the world, they weren't interested, שכל הדורות היו מכעיסים ובאים, עד שבא אברהם אבינו, till Avraham came along, וקיפד שכר כולם. And he accepted the wages of all of them. So what does that mean? So here again, there are different concepts in Chazal. There's one concept where Chazal say that a tzaddik could end up with the sachar of a rasha. That concept exists. There's a place where it says that if someone says lashon hara on someone else, then his sachar goes to that person. There are all kinds of different quotes in Chazal. There's another concept, which I think is an interesting concept for us to walk away with, and that is that every person is created with potential. Every one of us has certain potential in tikkun olam, in moving the world forward. We know that every one of us has potential in Torah that no one else has, but we also have potential when it comes to the world, making the world a better place, making the world a more advancing the world. In that regard, every one of us has potential, and that's part of what every person, when he lives a correct life, that's part of what he discovers. Now, part of that is you build a good family, you build a good home, you've already accomplished a lot. You make a living, you support your family, you live a good Jewish life, you've already done a lot. Hopefully, you could expand beyond that. Hopefully, you could also bring in guests into your home, do achnasat ochim, give loans, do chesed. But that's already step two. But the mere fact that you're living a normal, productive life, that's already something. Like we say, what's Yishuv Eretz Yisrael? Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is coming here and making a living here and helping the economy here. And that's what the Avnei Nezer said. Why didn't everyone come to Eretz Yisrael? He said, he's a Hasidish Rebbe. Why doesn't he come to Israel? He says, because the concept of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is to live here and live productively here. He says, if I go to Eretz Yisrael, I'd have to live off of my Hasidim in Europe. That's not called Yishuv Eretz Yisrael when someone else is funding me. I got to be productive here. That's Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so that was his point. But at the end of the day, a person is fulfilling Yishuv Olam. He's helping the world civilization by the mere fact that he's a productive individual. So every one of us is given potential to advance the world. If the 10 generations from Noach till Avram were not advancing the world, quite the contrary, they were moving backwards until Avram came along and the whole world, he says, no, we got to be more productive, and he teaches them how a person is supposed to lead a correct, productive life. So Avram took the whole world and he moved it forward. So that's another understanding in why he was kibel sachal kulam. Noach didn't do that. Noach was able to save his own family and the rest of the world was destroyed. That's why about Noach, it doesn't say that he got the wages that all of them were supposed to get, because he didn't move them all forward. Avram did. Which leads us to the third understanding, which is that Avram got wages for all of them because Avram really moved everyone forward. The second understanding was that Avram moved the world forward in being himself. The mere fact that he stood against the tide. Third understanding is that he educated them to move forward. And a fourth understanding, which is also important, is that there's a marked difference between when everyone's doing what's right and we do what's right, or when the whole world's doing what's wrong and we do what's right. When the whole world was saying Nimrod is a god, he's a deity, and Avram stood up and said, no, he isn't. So now we know Avram was imprisoned for 7 years, and he was put in a prison where he had no light, and they fed him a drop of bread every day, and they tried to break him. And we know all the different stories about how Avram was tortured until finally Avram came out of there with a book that he composed, 400 chapters about why you shouldn't be a pagan, Masechta Avodah Zarah. And ultimately they saw they couldn't win him, so they threw him into a burning furnace, and he walked out alive, and that's why Nimrod is called Amraphel. And then Avram walks out, and the world has to stand back. And Avram amasses his own army. We know that Avram had 300 men on hand. You know, on hand. In 1 second, he's told that over 300 men. He's told that his nephew's captured. In 1 second, he mobilizes. He has over 300 knights on hand. Right, the Gematria of Eliezer. Yeah. 18 or 30. right? 318, he has Anhind. Avram became very wealthy and he became a world power. According to Chazal, they reached a point where the world put together a UN and appointed him king of the world, so to speak, secretary general. He's in charge of the UN. So Avram reached a point where he was a world power, but he started off called Avram HaIvri. Why is he called the Ivri? Because Kol Olam Be'Ever Echad, all the world stood on one side and he stood on the other side. And they all told him, Avram, you're crazy. What do you mean there's a God we can't see, we can't hear, he doesn't talk to us, we don't know him, he knows us? What do you mean? The sun must be the God. The moon must be the God. What are you talking about, Avram? Everyone knows it's not like you're saying. And Avram stood up to everyone. So that's why we say that Avram kibel sechav kulam doesn't mean he got their wages. But he got the wages of standing up to all of them. The fact that he was in a place where no one else was believing in God, that's why he got much more wages. Which leads us to a very interesting Rabbeinu Yonah. The Rabbeinu Yonah says that these Mishnayot are an undercover way of encouraging the Jews throughout the period of the exile. It says, we see that the other religions seem to be in power. Today we, Baruch Hashem, we have a country, we have a state, we have an army. Okay, but think back 100 years, when Jews lived at the whim of the governors and country after country expelled them. You know, Jews were expelled. What country weren't we expelled from?
China.
Forget China, okay. Forget the pogroms. Okay. Good to know. I didn't know that. Okay. So the fact that we were living generation after generation where the nation seems to be successful and we're being downtrodden, that was the major Christian claim, right? They kept saying, if you're the chosen people, why do you live the way you do? Why do you look like you do? So Rabbeinu Yonah says that this Mishnah is an undercover way of the Tanaim giving us a shot in the arm, saying this isn't the first time that God put up with people for generations when they were sinful. Until Avram came along, and because he stood for what was right, he got the wages that all of them didn't get. So even though things are taking time and God is putting up with a lot of nonsense, so to speak, God is letting them get away with a lot of things. At the end of the day, remember, Avram also stood up. He was a lone soldier. So the Rabbeinu Yonah says that's what the Mishnah is alluding to. And here there's also a very interesting Rashi. Rashi says, our next Mishnah tells us, Asara nisyonot nitnasa Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu was tested 10 tests. So we have a whole long class we discussed what's this concept of tests. Why does Avraham need to be tested? What does that mean? And we had a long discussion about that, about bringing something out from within, recognizing our potential, realizing our potential. We discussed that nisayon is an uplifting. We discussed many different understandings as to what is a test. Why does a person get tested? I think it's in our Pirkei of the Ezer class, among other places. So, Avraham Avinu had 10 difficult situations that Ve'amad Bekulan, he stood up to all of them, Lo'odia kama chibato shel Avraham Avinu, to show us how much love Avraham Avinu had for God. Now, Rashi says as follows. The 10 tests, so he enumerates the 10 tests. You guys want me to go through what were the 10 tests? Yeah? Okay, so 10 tests, he says, were as follows. Firstly, and you should know, there's a machlokas in the enumeration of the 10 tests. Meaning, there are different opinions how we enumerate them. Rashi quotes one opinion here, and that is, he's quoting from Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, that initially when he was a kid, so Nimrod wanted to kill him, and he was underground for 13 years. Then he was thrown into the furnace. That's number two. Number three is he was exiled from his home territory. Number four, he just comes to Israel. God told him to come. And for the first time in world history, there's a famine. God just sent him to the land of Israel. God told him, come here. He comes, no food. Suddenly, first time in world history, there's a shortage of food in Canaan. He has to leave. He goes down to Egypt. And his wife is abducted by Pharaoh. That's test number five. God told him to come to Israel. Because he followed God's instructions, he ended up in a famine, had to go to Egypt. His wife is abducted into Pharaoh's home. Number six, his nephew Lot, he just gets, he finishes the ordeal with Sarah, he heads back to the land of Canaan, and his brother Lot, his nephew, is abducted. Number seven, and then that included in all that is the war. Number seven is that he was given the godly revelation that his children would be taken under the nations. He sees a revelation. God says, you should know you're going to have kids. And now let me show you what's going to happen to your kids. They're going to be taken by the Egyptians. They're going to be taken by the Romans. They're going to be taken by the Persians. They're going to be taken by the Babylonians. God shows them all of world history, how we're going to suffer nation after nations. That was a test, even though it was a vision of prophecy. Number eight, he was commanded to circumcise. He's an old man, almost 100 years old. He was 100 years old. He has to circumcise himself and his son. Number nine, he's told by God to chase out the one sole heir that he has together with his maid who he lived with, Hagar. And number 10 is the Akedah. He's commanded to take his son up to the mountaintop to slaughter him. So those are the 10. And everyone that happens, he doesn't think, well, what's God doing? He doesn't start thinking, what's God up to? He says, I love God. I know He's running the world. I know He's good. And I know whatever He's doing, saying is for the good. He listens. And he doesn't start questioning. So those are the 10 tests. And we discussed in when we learned the Ntivot Shalom, the Slonim Rebbe writes, he says that the major point in Avram's test was not only that he did what God told him, but that he did it with love, without thinking, well, why and how can this be? So Avram stood up to 10 tests. And we say the Mishnah, Rashi learns that all the Mishnayot till here were lead-ins to this Mishnah. The Mishnah stresses that the world was created with 10 declarations to show a correlation between Avram, who stood up to his 10 tests, and the world. To tell us that the world exists in Avram's merits.
Who said
it? Rashi. Rashi on the Mishnah. What? Matzinu ba'agada. Asra nisyonot on Mishnah Gemo. God waits 10 generations from Adam to Noah. That's again, God doesn't want to destroy the world that was created with 10 declarations. He's hoping they'll do tshuva. They don't do tshuva. God waits another 10 generations. And then Avram saves the whole world because he brings the whole world back. He teaches them about monotheisms. And then Avram, that's why Avram gets the schar, because he kept the world going. That's what we said. The tzaddik, that was the introduction. The first Mishnah said God created the world with 10 declarations to tell us he'll pay good wages for the tzaddik who keeps the world going and pay back the rasha. Who's the tzaddik? That's a lead into Avraham Avinu, that he kept the world going. He saved the world by teaching monotheism. And then corresponding to his 10 tests, we have the ten miracles that God did on behalf of his children, the Jews in the desert. That's the next Mishnah. And then because of the fact that he stood up to his 10 tests, even though the Jews sinned 10 times in the desert, God didn't abolish them. So that's how Rashi learns that all these Mishnayot are all connected to Avraham. They all revolve around Avraham. Now here there's a fascinating Rav Chaim Yivilozhin, which is quoted often, and it's worth knowing. Rav Chaim Yivilozhin says, how come in the previous Mishnah, the Mishnah enumerates, it says there are 10 generations from Noach to Avram, and it doesn't call him Avram Avinu. And in our Mishnah, the Mishnah suddenly calls him Avram, our patriarch, our forefather. Why? So Rav Chaim Yivilozhin says, you look at Avram, Avram Avinu took his son up the mountain, he agreed, and he came back with his son. You had people during the Inquisition who, for the faith of God, the Inquisitor took the child and said, go against your faith. And then they started torturing the child, the parents, and neither one broke. And they saw their child going before their eyes, and they didn't break. They said, no, I'm not giving up on the faith. You had generation after generation where Jews had tests that on the face of it were no less than Avram Avinu's test, his tenth test, the epitome of his tests, and they stood up to the test. So, to an extent he says, yes, Avram Avinu did great things, but so did other Jews. So Rav Chaim Yivilozhin says, he says a point which I think is that's why it's quoted so often. He says, it's true. We stand up to all kinds of tests. There are other Jews that stood up to tests. But the key point that the Mishnah is telling us is that when Avram stood up to those tests, He made a mark, so to speak. He made a genetic change. He made something different about himself and his family, so that when we stand up to those tests, we're getting our strength from Avraham Avinu. And that's why, says Rav Chaim Yigalozhin, that's why this Mishnah stresses Avraham Avinu, our father, Avraham. He stood up to those tests to remind us that he not only stood up to those tests himself, but he also gave us the strength to stand up to those tests. Okay, let's move forward. There's coffee and milk and sugar, and everyone's invited. I see that heads are drooping. Maybe we'll open some windows. We'll get some fresh air. You see from your angle, from my angle, heads are drooping. And candies.
Candies?
Yeah, what kind of candy do you like?
Oh,
coffee, vanilla, or mint?
You don't have those funny ones anymore? Whatever happens.
Coffee, vanilla, or mint? In the office, I gave the last cup to the last class. Got vanilla, yeah. Just warm milk. Coffee, vanilla, or mint.
Sorry?
Coffee, vanilla, or mint.
Vanilla.
Yeah, this class is a vanilla class. I'm sorry. Yeah. Coffee or mint. I'm all out of vanilla, I think. Coffee or mint? Yeah? Okay. Coffee or mint? Yeah. Okay, so now we have coffee. Let's continue. Mishnah Dalid. Mishnah Gimel were the 10 tests of Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu was tested the 10 tests and he stood up to all of them. That was Mishnah Gimel. The 10 generations were still Mishnah Beis, and the 10 tests are Mishnah Gimel. Mishnah Dalid. Asara Nisim Nasu Lavotenu B'Mitzrayim. 10 miracles happened to our forefathers in Egypt. And here again, the commentaries enumerate them. A simple understanding is that we were saved from the 10 plagues. 10 plagues came on the Egyptians and we were saved. Vasara layam. And 10 miracles happened to our forefathers by the sea. So here again, the commentaries go into what were the 10 miracles. Let's leave that. You could look. The Rambam enumerates it. Rashi enumerates it. Asaran nisyonot nisu avotenu tamakom b'midbar. Our forefathers tested God 10 times in the desert. Shneimaos, the verse says, "Vaynasu oti ze eser pa'amim v'lo shamu v'koli." When what was test number 10? The meraglim, the spies, right? God says they've tested me 10 times, and that's it. I've had it. So test number 10 was the spies, and then the commentaries enumerate what were the previous 9. So. Why weren't we abolished after the 10 tests? So that's what Rashi says. That's the merit of Avraham Avinu standing up to his 10 tests. Mishnah. Correct. Mishnah. Asara nisim nasu l'avotenu b'beit hamikdash. And here the Mishnah is going to enumerate 10 miracles happened to our forefathers in the temple. Our sages said that when a woman smells meat, so one of two things can happen when she's pregnant. She could be revolted by the meat, or she could have tremendous desire for the meat, and either one could harm her pregnancy. That's why it says in Halacha, if a woman on Yom Kippur smells someone making a mangal, someone has good meat on their stovetop or wherever it is, she smells good meat, and suddenly she really wants good meat. So then we try to remind her, you know, it's Yom Kippur, can you calm down? And if that helps her, so good. And if not, we give her the meat. Because our sages said that if a woman is pregnant and she suddenly has a very, very strong craving for something like meat that's right there, and you don't give it to her, it could hurt her pregnancy. So how we apply it halachically, everyone will ask the local Orthodox rabbi. But women were coming into the temple, and on the temple, in the temple, you had the altar. On top of the altar, you had a ton of meat burning, right? So you'd smell it from far away. You could smell the barbecue, so to speak, the meat that's burning on the altar. And even so, no woman had any problem, any miscarriage or anything from the smell of the holy meat. Yeah?
Isn't that just because it's nonsense? I mean, I've never heard of anything like that in modern day.
You've never heard of anything like that in modern day? I don't even know of anything like that in modern day. But two things. One thing is that things did change. We know things changed. There are a lot of things the Talmud discusses that we know just aren't like that anymore today. The Talmud tells us different things about the physiology of men and women in their time. They saw it. I mean, and we know things changed.
Are we allowed to just think that maybe they were wrong?
So it's a little far-fetched to say they were wrong, because they knew from facts. This wasn't fiction. Meaning, when they tell us that a woman might miscarry on Yom Kippur and they permit her to eat, that wasn't a guess. So the question is, maybe today that we're so well fed, our cravings are less. You have to remember, they were living in a time where a woman, they said, you have to check the cracks of your wall. Why? Because when people had cracks in the wall, they'd fill them with dough. And when they were extra hungry, so they'd break off a piece of the dough and eat it. You filled it with dough 6 months ago. So, okay, fine. But right now I'm hungry, I have nothing else to eat, right? So we live a different life. We'd never contemplate eating that. We don't have to worry that maybe in Pesach, in the middle of the Seder, I'll break off a piece of the dough and chew on it, right? But they lived a different life. So it could be their cravings were also different. It could be that they also affected them differently. I don't know. I mean, before we rule on this halakhically, we have to check out, like you're saying, we've never heard of a woman miscarrying today. Okay.
No, but two questions. So you're saying they might have been almost at the point of malnutrition, definitely, and starvation in a sense. So maybe like the concept of eating meat could disrupt a woman's senses so much.
I'm saying, before we jump to conclusions, we have to remember that we live a totally different life than they did.
No, but even now, if you look at people in Japan, they were very small. They now eat meat, they're bigger. And I used to work for years at a company that worked with Japanese people. The kids who lived in America, when they got back to Japan, were bigger. So it's true, the diet makes
some
huge amount of physiological changes.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there are a few things our sages say affect our physiological changes. Also the fact that we have light and we're up this late at night, that also affects us. And the fact that we have a haphazard schedule and our eating schedule is different, that also affects us physiologically. These are things that are relevant also practically. It's relevant also, in areas where because we're aware of this, one of the ways we could help people in certain medical situations is by putting them back on regimens at the time of Chazal. There are different instances where we do that and we have success. That's what I'm just saying. Let's not jump to conclusions. Chazal were intelligent people. They researched things as best they could in their days. If they said that women miscarried from a desire after smelling meat, so we don't understand it, but I wouldn't say they were silly. We have to have respect. They were very smart people.
Yeah. Studies that show that women actually do miscarry in a certain sense, like not to be vulgar, but urine is one of them.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Look at that. Did you hear what he just said? Okay. So you and I don't know, but he knows. Okay.
Hipila
is the miscarry. Yeah. So what were the 10 miracles on the Temple Mount? Number one, no woman miscarried from the smell of the holy meat. Number two, so technically every sacrifice has to be brought up onto the altar within a day or maximum 2 days. And after that, it gets burnt outside, it has a special burning place. But this is only true if the meat remains at the foot of the altar. Once the meat was brought up to the top of the altar, so then it could stay there for days. And sometimes it had to stay there for days till they got to deal with it. Now, think about it. You have meat sitting next to a fire. It's pretty warm up there, but it's not burning because the Kohanim are walking up there. And it could sit there for 2 days. Now, no refrigeration. What would we say? That meat's terrible, right? It's going to start stinking. It's going to bring flies. Who knows what's going to happen? Tells us the Mishnah, one of the miracles that happened was that lo yisrech b'sar kodesh me'olam. The meat on top of the altar never went sour, never went bad. You never had bad smell, nothing. Never went bad, the meat that's up there. They had next to the altar, down below on the floor, they had an area called Bet Mitbachaim, where they had metal tables, and that was where they'd cut up the meat. So, you ever go to a butcher shop? What do you see at a butcher shop? You see flies, right? Tells us the Mishnah. In the temple, you never saw a fly. That was one of the things that God did to indicate that He was there. Yeah.
But these things are they're miraculous. The first one could just be people, like there could be a different miracle that nobody realized because they counted the first one in as the first of the 10 miracles.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? Like the other ones that are miraculous are easy for me to accept because they're miraculous. And the first one is just, it sounds...
Yeah, but we have to be a little open-minded. Sure. We're used to viewing things from our eyes. And we have to remember that there are things that we don't understand. We don't understand about how they lived. If they said that in their time it was healthy to eat fish just before it goes bad. Right? That's what they said in their time. So they knew what they were talking about. If they said, I'll give you an example of a cure. They said if a child has an eye infection, so take saliva from the morning. When you empty it, brush your mouth, wash your teeth, eaten anything, drank anything, put it in his eye and it'll cure his eye infection. What do you say to that?
I got some silly grass that my brother told me to put on my bug bite to make it work. So that's fine.
So I'm telling you, it happens to be that for many eye infections it works. People do it. The Tosfos says we don't do the medicine in the time of the Talmud because Tosfos already says our physiology changed. Things changed. Our lives are different. Our diets are different. Everything's different. But you see that they said all kinds of things. I mean, it says Shmuel knew how to tell by looking at the river, at the waves, what's the deal, what the weather is going to be, and what the water will cure right now. I mean, if you drink from this water, it'll be good like this. You drink from that water, they knew how to tell. It says that in the time of Noah, they understood the earth. They could taste the earth and tell you what to plant in the earth. They could look at the earth, and the Talmud tells us there are veins running through the earth. Meaning there are areas where certain nutrients, certain strengths go through the earth, and if you plant a tree on this vein, what the Gemara calls veins in the earth, then you'll get a good, this is a good place to plant grapes, this is a good place to plant apricots, etc. So the same thing with the human body. We view it with Western medicine. The Western understanding has a lot of understanding, but there are other routes to curing things that we don't know. So by the same token, we don't know why women miscarry. I'll give you an example. You ask a doctor today, will climbing steps or carrying weights cause a woman to miscarry? Should a woman be careful from that? All the doctors I spoke to said, no, nothing to worry about. If a woman's supposed to miscarry, she'll miscarry, and if not, not. Then you have a theory, you have a contradiction to that. Because when a woman is put in a situation where it's a delivery at risk, right, an at-risk pregnancy, so then they tell her, don't climb steps, don't carry anything heavy. A lot of things they forbid her to do. Wait a second. If that can't cause her to miscarry, so why do you tell me not to do that when a woman's at-risk pregnancy? The answer, the statistic is so low that modern medicine says, we don't worry about that. There's a certain statistic. From our perspective, we're not worried about that. Well, the halacha does not work with the same formula that modern medicine does. Meaning there can be instances, and there are instances, where modern medicine says, we're not worried about that. And halacha says we are worried about that. So this can be one of those examples where you're right. Most women will not miscarry, but from our perspective, if we say 1 in 10,000 will, right? So when we give halachic ruling, we're giving halachic ruling to 5 million people, all the Jewish people. Well, if 1 in 10,000 will miscarry, then we're causing 1 in 10,000 to miscarry. There's a difference between answering one person and answering 2 million or 5 million or 10 generations or all generations for all time. So Chazal took that into account as well. And so we said 2 points. A, our statistical view of medicine is different than modern medicine. And B, we view the big picture. Okay, so back to our Mishnah. The Mishnah said, what are the 10 miracles? One, a woman wouldn't miscarry from the smell. Two, the meat never rotted on top of the altar. Three, you never saw a fly by the area where they chop up the meat. Four, lo yira keri lekoin gadol biyom kippurim. We know you had a kohen gadol, and the kohen gadol, he's the one that's supposed to be doing the special service. And it can happen that a person will sometimes, especially if he's been away from his wife for the last 7 days, it can happen that he'll have a discharge over the night. Never happened. Never throughout the history of the temple. So that was considered a miracle. Notice, this is one of the 10 miracles, meaning it would have been normal that it should have happened. The guy's he's alone, and he's supposed to take extra care that shouldn't happen. And you know what happens when you're always careful that something shouldn't happen. It's exactly what does happen, right? It's not only Murphy's Law. There's also psychologically. It's like when you walk into a meeting and you tell yourself, I'm not going to say this word, right? You're at a meeting and the guy is, I don't know what, he's... okay, so you say, I'm not going to say that word. And then you end up saying it. That's the way it works. I'm careful, something shouldn't happen. It's at the tip of our tongue, it's at the tip of our thoughts. So by the same token, the Kohen Gadol has to be extra careful. And we took care. We didn't feed him the foods that would cause it. We kept him up all night so that he shouldn't sleep and that shouldn't happen. But at the end of the day, it could still happen. And the Mishnah enumerates this as one of the 10 miracles. Yeah. So, No, that day. Carry if it happened the day before. So, the Mishnah says, Be Yom Kippurim, on Yom Kippur. I have a job, but I didn't see anyone that says it, so I don't want to say it. Right. It's a good question. I was looking, I didn't see anyone that... give me one second. I didn't find... I have a pshat, but I'm not sure... this is a question that should have bothered someone before me and you, right? So, I didn't see someone that says it. I don't know. I could tell you pshat, but I'll tell you, but I'm not sure if it's right. You have to remember that in the time of the Second Temple... Let's start. We know the Kohen Gadol was Ezra and then Shimon HaTzadik. Who's Kohen Gadol after Shimon HaTzadik? So he had two children, Chonio and Shimi, right? When Shimon HaTzadik passed away, he said, Chonio, you're my younger son, you're the Talmud Chacham, you should be Kohen Gadol. Chonio initially said to his big brother Shimi, you're my big brother, I don't want to step on your toes, you be Kohen Gadol. Then Chonio had second thoughts, so he came back to Shimi and he said, on the day of inauguration, the way you do it, Shimi comes to Chonio, he says, what should I do on the day of inauguration? I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Shimi wasn't learning it at all. So Chonio tells him, you show up in your wife's nightgown. Show up to the temple in your wife's nightgown, that's how you show up the first day for inauguration. Chonio goes to the temple the first day of inauguration, he calls the rabbis, he says, my brother Shimi is such a bum. His wife told him, if you really love me, you'll show up in my nightie to services. And that's what he's going to do. So Shimi shows up in the nightie and they're ready to kill him. So Shimi says, what do you want from me? I don't know. I really don't know. I asked my brother Chonio. Chonio told me this is what I'm supposed to do. So then they were ready to stone Chonio. So Chonio packed his bags and fled out to Alexandria in Egypt to save his skin. And he set up a temple there for idol worship. A temple which initially was not idol worship. It devolved to idol worship. Think about it. Who's Kohen Gadol? So Shimi is a guy who doesn't know that he's not supposed to show up in his wife's nightie. His brother could pull the wool over his eyes. That's the first generation that we know. After you have Ezra, Shimon HaTzadik, and bam, off the bat, that's where we're holding. So it's a pretty problematic period, the Second Temple, right? As far as Kohanim Gadolim go. Our sages say they didn't make out their year. Everyone wanted to be Kohen Gadol. They'd go into the Holy of Holies, they'd come out, and they'd die that year. They wouldn't make it out. Some died inside, some died outside, but they didn't make it through the year. So these weren't especially righteous people. So I think that might be part of the answer. That in spite of that, this didn't happen. Maybe. Again, I'd like to see someone say it. It bothers me. I think it might be a true pshat, what I'm saying, but I didn't see anyone saying it. So I want to see. That's my guess. That's my thought. Maybe that's the correct pshat.
What, if they weren't righteous?
We know they weren't righteous people. That it says. But to say that's what the Mishnah means, even though the Mishnah tells us in Yuma they kept them up all night. They wanted to ensure they wouldn't fall asleep. So he's saying, if you're up all night and you're working all day, how could a guy see carry? Where's it going to happen? So I'm saying, maybe even when you keep up a guy up all night, his thoughts can wander and a lot of things can happen. When he goes to the bathroom, there are these areas where you don't have control over him. So I'm saying, maybe that's part of it. I don't know. Again, it's my guess. I'm not sure. Yeah, you want to say something else? And the rainwater never put out the fire. Even though it rained on the altar, it never put out the fire. Velo nitzcha ruach et amud ha'ashan. There was a special brass that they put in with the fire of the ktores, and then there was a miracle that the fire of the altar went up into a straight column and then spread out. It went in a special shape. So even though you had a pillar of smoke, which was a special pillar of smoke, the wind never overcame it. And you have these three sacrifices of flour. There was never something that caused them to be disqualified. They'd stand so squished, so put together, that people were like tzaf. Tzafuf in modern Hebrew just means squished. In ancient Hebrew, tzafuf means tzaf. It means floating. Meaning they were so compact. There were so many people standing on the festivals at the temple that some of the people were floating. Their feet didn't touch the ground. They were standing by mere force, by pressure, the fact that they were squished together. Omdim tzfufin. And yet, when they'd bow down and they'd say their confessions, umishtachavim revachim. They'd bow down, there'd be space for everyone. How'd that happen? So that was one of the miracles. God didn't want people to be right next to one another when he's confessing. You should hear what he did wrong. It's none of his business. God made it that when they bow, there'd be space. A snake and a scorpion never harmed someone in Jerusalem. Now remember, Jerusalem isn't what we call Jerusalem today. Jerusalem is probably within the old walls. A person never said to his friend, you know, there are no vacancies in the motels now. I got no place to stay tonight. I can't stick around in Jerusalem. So a person never had that issue. There was always room for everyone in Jerusalem. That was one of the miracles. So there was a lot of Achnasas Orchim going on. But this, the Mishnah says, was one of the miracles. Let's try to get two more Mishnayot in. Yeah, you guys have koach? Okay. Asara dvarim nivra'u be'erev Shabbat ben Hashmashot. Are we awake? Good. So let me ask you a philosophical question which has halachic implications. When God created day and night, so what did God create? Did God create day and night, right? And then we say that the twilight, what we call Ben HaShmashos, isn't a godly creation. It's an area where we're in doubt. We cannot discern when's the specific moment that it switches from day to night. That's one understanding, right? There's a human time. There's a time where we humans cannot discern. We don't know at which split second it switches over. So we have times which we call twilight, where we don't know which it is. So that's the understanding we'd usually go with. Or do we say no? God created day, God created night, and God also created twilight, a time that's in between. Meaning, if I ask God, do you ever have twilight? Will God answer me, yes, I have a time that's called twilight? Or God will answer me, no, twilight is your problem. I only have day and night. I have the minutes, the hours when it's day, I have the hours when it's night. There's no in between. So you'd all opt for the former, right? In God's world, there is no twilight. That's what we'd usually say. We'd go with the first thing we presented. Yeah? If we'd ask God, do you have Ben HaShmashos? What would God say? We'd assume not. God doesn't have twilight. God knows when it's day, when it's night. It says God created day and night. So now let's read our Mishnah. Asara dvarim nivra'u be'erev Shabbat Ben HaShmashot. 10 things were created Friday afternoon and twilight. What does that mean? God created in twilight, God didn't create. If we say that God has no twilight, God doesn't have Ben HaShmashot, so what does it mean God created in twilight? Did God create it by day or by night? Right? Good question. Yeah? Fair? Okay. So, this is one of the sources that led me to think that maybe God created twilight. Maybe if you'd ask God, do you have Ben HaShmashot? Maybe God would say, yeah. Well, we could say that there is no such time as twilight. Twilight is a man-made problem. I'm saying God created day and night. Could be, I don't know, I can't discern, so I have Ben HaShmashos. So this Mishnah is one source that would seem to indicate, and I think it's a Machlokas Tanoim, in the Gemara in Shabbos and in the Gemara in Erevin, that's what I think, but I'm not sure I'm right. I'm saying, even if we say that that's what this Mishnah means, that if we find sources that go the other way, that won't bother me too much, because I think that there are sources going both ways in Chazal. The Mishnah says there are 10 things that were created on Erev Shabbos, Friday afternoon, Ben HaShmashos, during twilight. Okay. Why is it important that these things would be created Friday afternoon during twilight. So there's a very interesting, what? It's not Shabbos yet, okay. Let's read, I want to quote to you a very interesting Rambam here that gives us a point for that we have to know for all of Tanakh. For Tanakh, for all of Judaism. The Rambam says as follows. ואולי תאמר, maybe you'll tell me, אחרי שכל הנפלאות כולם הוסמו בטבעי הדברים מהם מששת ימי בראשית, we're going to read, maybe we should read the Rambam after we finish the Mishnah. Okay, let's, I'm sorry. We'll get to the Rambam after we read the Mishnah. Let's read the Mishnah and then we'll read the Rambam. Mishnah says like this, עשרה דברים נבראו ביום שבת בין השמשות. 10 things were created on Friday of creation, on the eve of Shabbos, and twilight, בין השמשות. Which also needs definition. What does it mean? Ben Ashmashot, between the suns. Ve'elohim. These are the things. Pi Aretz, the mouth of the earth. We know the earth opened its mouth, swallowed up Korach and his men. That's number one. Pi Aver, the mouth of the well. We know there was this miraculous well. Wherever they went, they'd have water in the desert, enough to feed the, to give 2 million people drink. So that's the second thing that was created on twilight of Friday, the Shabbos of creation. Piaton, the mouth of that donkey that spoke to Bilam. Vakeshet, the rainbow. We'll have to see which rainbow. Vaman. Vamate, the staff of Moshe Rabbeinu. Vashamir, and that special worm called Shamir, that wherever you place this worm, it cracks. It emits some kind of acid, or however it works. It could crack almost anything in the world. Haktav. Vamichtav, the writing, the letters, however you want to, we'll define that in a minute. Valuchot and the luchos. Yeshumim ava mazikin. Some say the mazikin, some kind of spiritual being that can harm people. Vikvuato shel Moshe, the burial place where Moshe was buried. We know that was miraculous. Veilosh l'Avraham Avinu, and the ram that Avraham Avinu took to, instead of his son. Veyeshumim av tzvat b'tzvat asuya. And some say that also the first clan that Adam, if he wanted to create things in fire, how could he do it? How does he start off? So God helped him out. God gave him a first clamp that he could hold things in the fire and he could fashion tools, and that was a godly creation. That's a, there's an opinion that God gave him tools to work with in the world. God gave him a clamp to work with fire. Svat. Svat is a clamp. Yeah, something you could hold things in the fire. Okay. So these are miraculous things. These are miraculous things. And these things were created. We need maybe to define a little bit better why Ktav, the letters, were created. And why the Mikhtav, according to one understanding, is the special pen that God used to engrave in the Luchos, the tablets, that also needs definition. And the burial plot of Moshe, so Chazal tells us it was miraculous. It says in Sota that the authorities wanted to discover it. They took a map, they took all the signs, they took old Arabs, they took old Jews. They asked them, how do you figure out where Moshe is buried? And they worked it out, and they figured out this is Mount Nebo. They went to Mount Nebo, they stood at the bottom, they looked to the top, they saw a cave. That's where Moshe is buried. They climb up to the cave, they hit the top, and they look down and they see the cave down below. They climb back down, they see the cave on top. So they say, okay, we'll split into two teams. Team number one goes up to the top of the mountain, team number two stays towards the bottom, team number one calls out to team number two, it's down there by you! Team number two calls out to team number one, no, it's up there by you, I see it by you. So that's a miracle, right? The cave, wherever they went, it looked like it was somewhere else. So Moshe Rabbeinu's cave was one of the miracles that were created at twilight. The ram of Avraham Avinu, that was an exceptional ram. We know that its horns are going to be, Mashiach's going to blow by them. That was, the one horn was used at Sinai. That's the horn that's going to be at the time of Mashiach. And the different parts of the ram, we learned, I think, in the Medrash, what the different parts were used for King David's harp, for all kinds of things. So that was a miraculous ram. So these are different things that defied the laws of nature. Says the Rambam. Maybe you'll tell me, being that all these things were built into creation, what does it mean God created it? That means that God placed an opening in earth, just where Korach would stand when Moshe was talking to him. And then when Moshe said, naturally it opened up and whoop, Korach goes down. So wait a second, from the beginning of creation that was the plan. That was already within nature. So then how do you call these miracles? So the Rambam says, Da, I want you to know, Shiloi Chadein, the Tana didn't single these ones out, Lomar She'en Shumofet Shusam Beteva Hadvarim Rak Eilu, to tell us that you won't find a miracle other than these. These are the things that were within nature that are miracles. Aval Amar She'elu Nasu Ben Hashmashot Levad V'Shar Niflot V'Amaftim Husmu B'Tivei Hadvarim Asher Nasu Bam Ve'et Ha'asotam Tchila. The Rambam says these 10 God did in twilight, all other miracles were put into nature. Meaning, let's say there would be no Jews leaving Mitzrayim. Would the sea split? Says the Rambam, yeah. There was a natural cause for the sea to split. God made a miracle. So why is it a miracle if it was placed into nature?
Time.
Says, oh, timing is everything. Ah, timing is everything. The Rambam says, and this is a very famous Rambam, the Rambam says that the timing, when we say God does a miracle, that doesn't mean that God changes everything in nature. Maybe God made something happen in the stars. Maybe God made something happen. There were two massive meteors that came by Earth, and they caused the pull. If we can figure it out, how it happened naturally that the Jews went through the Yam Suf, yes, but at the end of the day, the Yam Suf split, the Jews went through, and it came tumbling down on the Egyptians. God told Moshe, you raise your staff, and then it will split. Now this Rambam needs work. But we should be aware that it exists.
So, the principle he's saying is that most miracles are built in nature.
So how far do we take this Rambam as a discussion? If you take it as far as you're saying, that's what the Ralbag does. The Ralbag wrote a work called Milchamot Hashem, and when he said what you're saying, so then the whole world came out in an uproar against him. More than the Mor Nebuchim. The question is, how do you rectify? There are things in the Tanakh that don't seem to work with this. Meaning, does the Rambam mean that every miracle is this way, or does the Rambam mean even when you find that miracles are this way, it shouldn't bother you? So we will expand our discussion of this concept, Bezrat Hashem, in our Friday class. In our Friday class, we're learning the Drashot Aran. So the Ran is going to address this point. The Ran is going to teach us that even Makas Bechoros, the 10th plague, he's going to explain that it was some kind of disease. God made a disease settle down in Egypt and kill all the firstborn. So that doesn't bother us. What the Rambam is saying is even when you find natural explanations, that doesn't bother us because God acts within nature. And the timing, like David correctly said, the timing is the idea of the miracle. Again, how far do we take this? So that we'll wait till the Ran.
So,
yeah.
In relation to what we're learning now, he's making a distinction between most miracles and this, but the fact that it's Ben HaShmashot is a completely different.
The Rambam's Lashon, the Rambam says like this. I prefer, I'm used to Rav Kapach's here, he words it a little differently, so I'm not sure. It says like this. The Rambam says, we didn't read this section yet, this was an earlier section, we skipped over it. He says, our sages taught us that Hashem, the Rambam says that these things were put into nature from the 6 days of creation. Why are these 10 singled out? So he says, not to tell you that all other miracles were not within nature, yeah, but to tell us that these were made on Ben HaShmashot. Other miracles were built into nature during their own time of creation. Meaning when God created the earth or God created the constellations, whatever participated in a miracle, those God did at their set times. These miracles, so to speak, God did something within nature on Ben HaShmashot. Why are these singled out? I don't know. According to the Rambam, I don't know why the Rambam, why according to the Rambam, these 10 had to be done at a separate time. All other miracles were built into nature when God created their nature, and these they had the set time benish mashos. I don't know why. I don't know. So there are other understandings. We just started with the Rambam. Okay. Says like this. ולמה הוא צריך למנות עשרה דברים אלו? Says the Rabbeinu Yonah, להודיע כי כל מה שברא הקדוש ברוך הוא על תנאי. וכשאומרים שהשתנו בטבעם בשעת הצריכה, שאין דבר מחודש בעולם שלא עלה במחשבה במעשה בראשית. The Rabbeinu Yonah seems to say that these are the 10 miracles which defy nature. Other miracles are within nature. And these 10, so to speak, Hashem, these 10 indicate to us that when Hashem created things in creation, so to speak, he gave a condition. Meaning these 10 indicate to us that we know nature, right? We say that there's nature, there's gravity, that we have natural explanation for things. What is nature? Nature is the way God lets the world keep going. But when God formed nature, at the end of God's forming nature, God finished creating nature, so God said, okay, now nature, I'm going to make 10 conditions with you for 10 miracles that I'm going to need on hand. So to speak, God made a condition. He said, before I'm finished with creation, I want you to know, I'm not going to let you run your standard course. Whenever I need, I'll make a break in nature. I'll change things. These 10 we're aware of. What about everything else? I think that these 10 were already pre-planned because they were part of the godly plan for the world. Everything else, God says, whenever I need, I'll make a change in the way, the natural course of how things run. These 10, God knew he needed. They were part of the godly plan for the world. So when God finished creation at the twilight, at the very end of creation, God said, I'm letting you go, world. Now you're going to have a natural course. The sun will set every night, will rise every morning, will leave a natural course. But I know there are 10 things I will need for the world. Those 10 things, I'm telling you right now, it's on a condition they're going to change. And every so often, I'm going to have to change the course of nature. And then I'm not letting you run your own course. Whenever I say, you're going to change. That's how the Rabbeinu Yonah seems to learn the Mishnah.
So would there not have a question on the freedom of the choice, the individual?
What do you mean? Why?
Yeah, these are very particular, some of the very particular miracles.
So that's a good question.
Specific.
Right. It's a good question. We could say that the people were concepts. When we say that before creation, God decided there has to be an Avram, we could say that that's a question. Would he be the Avram, or would someone else be the Avram? If we want to, we can answer that way. Same thing with Moshe. God tells Moshe, you go take him out. If you don't go, no one else is going to take him out. What does that mean? Moshe didn't have Bechira Chofshit? It means right now you're the only one that has the potential to do the job.
For some of them, that's what it would
do. What?
For some of them, it would work.
And for what not?
The donkey.
Well, donkeys don't have to have Pirach of Sheet. He had a donkey that was created.
The fact it was created because of Bilam was at the same particular situation.
Ah, that's what you're saying. So I don't know what to do with the donkey's mouth for many reasons. Meaning your question can be added to a pile of questions. The donkey's mouth is one line in the Mishnah I don't understand.
God controls kings and gods. You could say Bilam is like a king because he's getting paid by and he's more in charge of stuff than the king. So at that moment in time, he is like the de facto leader of a people, so he's a king.
This requires a much longer discussion. I mean, this goes into the whole concept of the whole Torah being written before the world was created. And how does that work with Bechira Chofshit? And it goes on to another discussion of what was Bilam's relationship with his donkey. You're assuming Bilam's relationship with his donkey just began there. And we have a tradition that it goes far back to when Bilam was a child, and that's how Bilam became the terrible Bilam that he was, one of the ways is through his relations with his donkey. So there's a lot to discuss about this donkey. There's much more to it. Huh? Yeah. Just a second. Yehuda.
Misunderstood time. We can't be certain what it is. So maybe this Mishnah is not saying that we should think of twilight as our general definition of twilight, but rather that it's just a time where you can't really define. He's saying all of the miracles, you might be able to say, okay, we're trying to find the way that it works in nature, but within these 10, it's impossible because these are in between, these are uncertain, unknown.
I think that the direction you're headed would work very well with the Rabbeinu Yonah. I mean, the Rabbeinu Yonah who makes the point, these were at the very end of creation. God says, okay, creation, I'm going to let you go now. Now I'm going to leave a natural order of things, even though we say, I'm chadesh betuvo b'chol yom tamid ma'asev reshit, we say in prayer. Every day God reenacts creation. He does creation. But there's an answer where God says, I'm going to leave things running this way. Either I run it this way, or I have my angels running this way, however you want to understand it. So according to the Rabbeinu Yonah, I think what you're saying works very well. It's simply an indication at the end of creation. The end of the day.
In regards to what you're saying about what's the point of this mission? The point of this mission is to tell you that, you know, like, it deters people if they can't think of a logical explanation of why something. I can understand like how that can be. I can understand that, you know, some cosmic energies created the sea to split. Right? But there's no understanding of the step. There's no understanding of the one's donkey. And these things you should accept this as, because these are twilight. Not necessarily created within the time of twilight, but they're twilight in the sense that we can't distinguish what it is. So don't let these 10 specific things
distract twilight.
Okay, yeah, fair. I hear.
He has just lifted up the sparks. Can I have another copy?